Good morning. I'm going to call the meeting to order at 10:01 a.m. Take a roll call. Jenny, go ahead.
Jenny Webster here.
Dasa Hill here.
Brandon Stevens here.
Lisa Summers here.
Fawn Bailey.
Trish King here.
Is David out of town, Lane?
Madison.
Okay.
He was here this morning.
Was he?
Yeah.
I'm expecting David shortly, and I believe the chairwoman is still out on funeral leave. So, and a motion to adapt the agenda with one change. There would be an add-on in executive session. The executive session number, new business number one, for the limited waiver of sovereign immunity for WX Bank contract 2017-0018. Is there a motion to adapt the agenda with that one?
So moved.
Change.
Support.
Motion by DeHasse, seconded by Fawn, to adapt the agenda with one addition to executive session new business number one. All right. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Abstentions? Motion carries. The first item on the agenda is the approval of the GTC Legal Resource Center. There's a memorandum that everybody should have gotten. This is in response to the General Tribal Council motion to establish a legal office that consisted of an advising attorney for the General Tribal Council, as well as advocates to serve there to be elected. So one of the reasons why it's coming to the business committee at this point is because there are two deadlines that are pending. First, the first deadline is today. At the end of today, I have to have something in the budget for the GTC Legal Resources Office. And by next week, election information is due to the election board for the names of the positions, the number of positions, the qualifications, term lengths, etc. So I could walk you through the memorandum, and I'm just going to ask for general consensus or discussion or debate on each of these items so that we can confirm, as this is a new creation of an office. So some of the business committee members were able to get feedback. I was able to get feedback from individuals. I was able to get feedback through work meetings. I was able to catch you guys at the end of meetings to try to come to some kind of consensus on these items. So we'll roll right through them. The name of the entity was decided already by the business committee by consensus. It will be the GTC Legal Resource Center. One of the main reasons the business committee selected the name was because of the site selection. The site selection will be at Ridgeview Suite number 8. That used to be the old Legal Resources Center. And there would be minimal signage changes needed to be made, as well as the business committee thought that that was pretty representative of what the intent of the office was. So are there any disputes about the name of the entity? None? Okay. Again, the location is Ridgeview Plaza Suite number 8, the old Legal Resources Center. We looked at two sites. One was the former Appeals Commission offices and Suite number 8, the Legal Resources Center. I brought Jessica Wallenfang as a GAL and former Judge Collins as a judge and attorney to kind of help me look at the space allocations and make sure that there was the necessary conference space in order to keep things confidential, if you know, for and also the necessary workings for an office of that type of nature. We selected Suite 8 based upon the ability of that space to be up and running by the time that we needed it. It has already computer access, it has conference room space, it has enough space for up to, I believe, 8 people. And so we're looking, and we also looked at future staffing needs, so we chose Suite 8. And plus it was cheaper, and the other one would have needed an administrative person to be in the office in order to greet people. So, anybody disputing the location of that facility? Okay. No. The discussion that the business committee did have surrounding the number of advocate positions took into consideration the following information. The caseload for the Oneida Judiciary. The GTC Legal Resources Center proposed is somewhat similar to Legal Resources Center, but not very similar at all because this opens up the case. I know it sounds funny that I say that, but from a location, space needs, office needs perspective, the offices are similar, but from a functional perspective, it is not. So one of the things that was that I provided for the business committee was that family court has the most number of cases. Family court has 29 hearings on average per month. There's no indication if those hearings are for the same case or not, so we don't know if they're for separate cases. Trial court has 194 for the year, with garnishments being the top, tribal debt coming next, and then others, 21 cases. Peacemaking sessions, 116. Appellate, they had 19 on their docket. I also listened to the audio from the General Tribal Council meeting on November 14th. The petitioner on the floor at the time suggested that there would be one attorney and six advocates, but at the time there was no justification as to why the number of advocates, and also from my perspective, there is no solid information to suggest that here's the number of cases per advocate or per the attorney. With that, the business committee in a work meeting did advise that I look at one, the GTC supervising attorney, and two advocates with the ability to, of course, take the next year to assess the office to see how busy they are and to add the necessary resources if we should encounter an inundation of cases for the advocates. So, That is significantly different from what the petitioner had in mind, but of course, on both sides, it's really just a guesstimate. There's no real hard numbers to say that any number is justified at this point other than the GTC advising attorney being one. So at this time, I wanted to know if there was any... And I listed that the petitioner, who is Gina, didn't agree with the number of advocates. Petitioner was agreeable with three advocates while assessing the office throughout the year. So I don't know, Gina, did you have some comments that you wanted to make? You can come sit with us. So while she's coming, again, I think it's really prudent, it has to be prudent of us to make sure that we're assessing the office throughout the year to make sure that they have the necessary individuals to continue to serve the community in this capacity. So, Gina, did you want to?
Yes, I am opposed to just bringing on two advocates. Like you said, and you have it documented, that in the GTC meeting I had suggested six advocates. Being that this would start into the fiscal year of 2017, and I'm thinking, what did you say, July, after elections, I would be willing to meet you guys halfway on this number, just because I do think that there is a need. We're talking the family court, we're talking trial court, and those other issues, but what I also raised in the meeting was like when individuals have issues with contract health and having someone help them litigate that if they don't pay their bills, and just some of the legal stuff that needs to take place. I know that's just one area that wasn't mentioned in here, with issues regarding having tribal members have their bills paid, medical bills and so forth. I know I'm one of them, so I know that you need an advocate for that to help you litigate, because they do have an appeal process if you don't agree with their determination of not paying a bill. So I just think three is a good number to start with, and then if they are overwhelmed, you know, at least it's just not on two individuals, you know, alongside with the attorney. So I'm not in favor of two. My intention was six. I would meet you guys halfway. Not that you can, you're going to negotiate it or not, because it sounds like you all made it some kind of a decision. But I think three is fair. I really do.
Lisa,
just I appreciate what you're stating, but normally when we do this type of work, and we did this with the judiciary. We did this with other areas that we're continuing to work on from an organizational perspective. We have some kind of an assessment that backs up that decision making.
Mm-hmm.
And at this point, we don't have that unless you have something else that you can present. And I, with all due respect, I know you have a lot of experience working from a personnel commission perspective on what, you know, and you have a better understanding than most of what caseloads look like and what it takes to actually carry out any type of activity once it gets started in the system. So I do appreciate that. However, what additional information do you have? And because we didn't get it at General Tribal Council, we didn't get it part of the packet, and nor do we have anything before us now that helps us justify the amount of money that would be spent for that based on the caseload information that we have. Because I think it's very important to understand exactly what's being presented here. We know family court, again, that preliminary number is 492 a year, but again, that might not be 492 unique cases. That could very well be, you know, half of that, or even less than half of that, depending on how many times. So, and maybe Rayanne, if you could answer that question for us at this point. Not necessarily generally for the, just specifically the family court, but when you're tracking those numbers, is it per event, and it can be the same case, but it's just different? Yes, it is. Okay. So we know that 492 number doesn't mean there's 492 unique cases. That means that's how many contacts or hearings there have been in the court for this, and it could be multiple times for the same case. So do you have any other thing that we can go off of from a caseload perspective or a time perspective about what that looks like, an analysis or anything?
Okay, so obviously I wasn't asked to bring that kind of documentation today. if you pull out the HRD's EGP, I forgot what that report is called. They do like a quarterly report. Mm-hmm. You will see in there how many employees within the nation are disciplined every quarter. Mm-hmm. And it varies from 200 to 300. Okay, so a lot of those cases that they never reach the judiciary. However, there could be that number is, I think it's kind of high. However, those advocates could also help with negotiating like settlements or just that employment number is very high. Although they don't reach my level, a lot of them don't reach my level, the personnel commission level or the judiciary, those advocates would be instrumental in negotiating with the supervisors, whether it be, whatever it could be that they would negotiate. But that number is high. That wasn't taken into consideration. I feel like I'm having a fight for just, you know, that and without the assessment. But like I said, originally, you know, I had stated on record in that meeting six advocates, because they would be taking on more than just employment. They would be taking on more than just family court. They would be taking on like housing evictions and such, probably even working with the garnishments. I'm not sure. I just know anything that's litigated, and just about everything in this tribe is litigated, they would be responsible for that.
And I think we have to be clear, too, because the motion at General Tribal Council was that they would represent tribal members and tribal employees, and it was clear about what that distinction was, employees for only personnel-related cases that would go. But it also says that have any type of litigation at the Oneida Judiciary. It didn't say what you're saying, contract health disputes. It's not. It doesn't talk about.
But that does get litigated at the, I believe that gets litigated, it can go to the judiciary.
Right. So unless the case gets to the judicial level at this time, I guess that's where the policy part of it is going to have to come into play about what can and can't they do, because there's also ethics that's involved for those individuals that have attorney licenses as well as paralegal licenses. They have certain ethics that they have to follow as well about representation and what kind of line that they can cross in terms of legal advice or representation as well. So those are some of the things that I think we've already kind of talked about. You know, that's why one of the questions that was answered was, do they follow the rules of admission? Yes, they do. Do they, you know, there's certain ethical practices that came into question for the attorney, but the attorney will be only representing under tribal law, not necessarily state law. So there's some differences there, but I just wanted to be clear that the motion at General Tribal Council was clear. It says any type of litigation at the Oneida Judiciary. So it, the advocates and the advising attorney would specifically be for any litigation that's at the judiciary.
Correct.
Not any other entity underneath it. So
I don't know that I would restrict that. I just really don't.
Well,
it says for any litigation that is, I don't have, is that motion right here?
Yep, that have any type of litigation at the Oneida Judiciary.
Right. So, Madam Chair,
just
to clarify then, Gina, I think that's why I'm asking the question, because to me, I understand what you're saying, and I don't disagree with what your intention is and what you're saying,
mm-hmm.
but what I'm saying is that those numbers would already be included in what we were able to get from the judiciary, because you're absolutely right. Those things can go to the judiciary now. So those, what you're talking about, if it applies to the judiciary and it's gone through the system, that's where we get the numbers from, and there's no additional information other than what we've already received to support additional people. That's why I'm asking for that, because mm-hmm. I agree with what you're saying, but the numbers are here, and if there's numbers that we haven't considered, because that's where we would be able to gather the data from, because they should have gone or should be included already in what we were already able to get from the judiciary. So what I'm asking is for is additional information. Because right now this is all we have to go off of. So I agree with what you're saying, how, you know, what they would, the scope and everything, but this is what we have for numbers right now at this point, and those should all have been counted in this numbering already if they would have gone there. So if somebody had a dispute, say through contract health, and they decided they needed to go to the judiciary to try to get it resolved, that's already included in this number. And so that's why I'm asking.
Well, no, I didn't bring anything with me. And, you know, I took into consideration those people that have tried to litigate and they're frustrated and they don't go any further. They're frustrated with the process. They don't want to go to the judiciary because they don't know the process. So you have a number of people out there that we don't have that number, the exact number of people that were frustrated and just quit. They just threw their appeal down or their paperwork down or whatever issue they had down, and they gave up because they didn't want to go to the judiciary. I don't have that number.
And that's why we're proposing, I mean, whatever number is selected today, that's why we're proposing to take that year to assess.
Okay.
So that if there's an over inundation and the advising attorney is coming even to the business committee and saying, hey, you know, I just don't have enough people to cover the number of cases, we're going to have to figure out how to get them the necessary resources and get them the advocates that they need in that office. So irregardless if it's one or if it's two, three, four, five, or six, we still have to take that year of assessment. And I think we'd rather, I understand what you're saying in terms of three, and I'm understanding where the business committee is saying two. At the same time, there is no solid information, irregardless of what we present from the judiciary, what you present, there's still no solid information or historical data that will say this is the number of cases per advocate. Irregardless, we can all speculate about what could be or what can be, but that's the whole thing. We're speculating. There's no real hardcore evidence from our side or from what you're saying for either of us to justify those numbers at all. And that's kind of the hard thing, is we're guessing here. So that's kind of why I think the committee said one and two, because the GTC advising attorney can also work on cases as well. So they wouldn't be limited to, even though they would be still advising General Tribal Council at their meetings or taking questions from the community. But I'm not justifying either way. It's really going to be, you know, I really just need a number to put on the ballot. So, Brandon?
And so the only thing that's really concerning to me now is just the partially the ethics, but the conflict of interest when you have two individuals that are going to be represented by the same office on the same docket. And so you have a child custody case or someone challenging paternity or whatnot. The same legal resource could be providing legal resources on both sides of the same case. And so that's kind of where my concern is. Like, I don't know if a number would really help that either, but it's more of the structure. And so that's what I'm kind of trying to, how can we help making sure that those ethics and that conflict of interest that's there can be adequately addressed when it's from the same office to Oneida's challenging paternity or custody placement, whatever that it may be. How do we get over that? So that's kind of the thing that I'm kind of worried about, is how do we address that? And I think it's once we hit that situation, I think we're going to have something to address that. So I don't know if it's GTC, I don't know if it's going to the petitioner, but we're going to have to find an answer for that, because that's a clear conflict of interest when you're being represented from the same office.
That was a question that we did ask the law office, and again, because normally that would be something from an ethical perspective, but Jim, you can help me out with this, that would be from an ethical perspective when you're representing in the state of Wisconsin. But again, we're talking about tribal law here, and that was one of the concerns that was brought forward from the judiciary, and it was brought from several committee members, and that's really going to be a decision on the attorney, and that's an unfortunate one, because the attorney is going to have to understand whether or not, somebody might file something against them for doing that in tribal court, and then that, I guess, will be the test from a state of Wisconsin license perspective. So that is going to be, I mean, we're following the directive of General Tribal Council, and that's one of the issues that is of concern, and that's one of the issues where we don't know if we're going to get candidates for the attorney, because that is an outstanding question about how to get that, how to relieve that. And I guess I would look when the LOC is in policy development phase, that's going to be one of those things about how do we address that issue from a policy perspective. So, but at this point, again, it's really determining the number of positions in order to, and the qualifications and those types of things in order to get these positions on the ballot. And then also determining the budget, because we have to go before GTC for the budget as well. So, Dehase?
I think there's also still kind of a outstanding question, too, around fairness. With the example of the family court, if you have a Oneida member and are disputing custody or whatever with the other parent, and the other parent isn't Oneida. So I think, to me, it seems a little bit unfair, because the tribal member will have this free representation, while the other parent of the Oneida child, who is not a member, might have to pay for their own attorney or advocate in that same system. So it's kind of, I guess, could be perceived as a little bit unfair going through the process, that the tribe's going to provide a tribal member with an advocate, and the other non-tribal parent could be not represented. So that's kind of a little bit of a fairness I guess issue that that would also have to be worked out through potentially, governing documents. But then also, as it relates to the number in the office being proposed at 2 and 1, I think it's I think that's a fair amount to start with. The because elections in July, the vote gets certified in August, and then the swearing in happens sometime in late August. From then on until the next caucus for the following year isn't a whole lot of time. So it's not like they're running a full year potentially short staffed. There will be another caucus, and that could be when we decide to add another one or two advocates and get these terms staggered as well. So if we're going to start, I don't remember, was the proposed term 4 years, 5 years?
The proposed term would be that the supervising attorney be 4. The first advocate would be 3, and the second advocate be 2, but then thereafter it would be 4.
So the next group coming on could have, be able to be staggered into that term as well. And so we're trying to do our best to address the caseload and not have an office that's overstaffed with not enough work to keep them busy, for a full-time position in this office. So I think it would be appropriate to continue to stay with 2 and have this, 8, 9, 10 months to assess the caseload per those advocates, and for that decision time to be made to bring forward the recommendation that we need, maybe we need to bring on 1 more or 2 more advocates, or four more advocates, depending on the caseload, within that, you know, within the next following 10 months after they're into up and running the office.
With regards to the question around representation, or excuse me, fairness, the perception of fairness, that issue had been vetted again with some of my colleagues as well as the law office. And unfortunately, it happens in every single court because low-income families are eligible for either free representation or representation by JudiCare. So JudiCare has a, you know, you have to qualify based upon your income. So if you have a person that is, in, you know, low income and can be represented, a person with medium income or higher income won't get the same representation as that low-income family. So there's already, I guess, unfairness in the court system from that perspective, and that's kind of how we've been able to mitigate. The judiciary is well aware of the concerns at hand and are going to work to make sure that that perception is mitigated from that perspective. So that was a huge concern at first, but then after getting some research and getting some feedback from everybody, that is not it's an issue, but it's not as a huge issue as it was in the beginning. Okay. Yeah.
I just wanted to comment that, too. I had wrote my notes about the intent of my motion was didn't mention non-tribals whatsoever, because they are going to be included in employees. But as far as I'm concerned, this is just for our tribal enrolled members and tribal employees who may be not tribal members. And as Melinda said, non-tribals, they can go to JudiCare. Whatever places they send them in town, when you go to court in Brown County, Green Bay, Outagamie, they must send them somewhere. Then maybe the judiciary could get that information and refer people that need help that are not tribal members and send them wherever they usually go when they go to outside court.
But that's the concern that I have as well with the way that the motion is worded, because it the way that it's worded, employees who are not tribal members now can access the service for any type of litigation, not just personnel-related litigation that they might have with the tribe. And so that is one of the reasons why I have a concern about that, because now we're talking about representing somebody to we're talking about representing somebody to litigate against the nation.
Okay.
In any format. That's the way that you worded the motion. So that's what we have to go off of. And that's why I have a concern about it, the situation that we're in. Because not only is it a concern with tribal members, you know, generally, because that, but now we're talking about you've included anybody who's an employee. So their status as an employee grants them access now to our legal system. Well, they could for any way potentially depending on the relationship and all the case history and, you know, federal law and all that stuff. But now we've specifically granted them a mechanism in order for them to be able to bring suit with representation against the tribe.
I would say we would clarify this in the policies, and we're talking about policies regarding conflicts of interest. We're talking about policies that would be developed for that office. Then that would be clarified in that policy. Why or how tribal employees for employment matters could utilize that office if they have to appear at the judiciary. You got to remember, Lisa, most of the employees that have any litigation, they're starting with an original hearing body. Okay, that's where they're starting. So if it's a tribal employee litigating an issue of employment, that's going to already go through an original hearing body. As far as, you know, I understand what you're saying. Maybe they're disputing a contract, health, whatever issue, or maybe they're being evicted. I don't know. But they would have to have started somewhere, you know, with an original hearing body. So they're going to already be involved in that legal process.
Not necessarily, and that,
okay.
And that's the concern, because so for instance, the authority that land management now has that the land commission would have had, that's being given to the judiciary. So the original hearing body is the judiciary now for any kind of cases when it comes to housing per se for land. So if you have a non-tribal member now who's not an employee, Does that, you know, so there, it gets really messy because now we have a specific class of people who are included in this. And you can say that we can clarify it through policy, but then that would be out of compliance with the GTC motion.
Well, then then maybe I'll need to come back and clarify my intention in General Tribal Council. Maybe that's what I'll need to do.
And that could very well be, and I think that's why I'm asking again, why I'm asking the questions, because there's some unknowns here at this point with regard to what you meant to do and then what was actually in the motion and what was approved and passed. Because everybody's going to, once this motion is passed, everybody walks away with a different understanding.
So what I want is then the opportunity to clarify that in General Tribal Council so it's clearly understood and approved the intention. That's what I find in motions from General Tribal Council from many, many years, that no one ever got the intent of the motion or they never brought it back, so people are just operating, well, this is what the motion said. This is what the motion said. But if you go back to the petitioner or whoever that person is and get clarification on record in a GTC meeting, then it clarifies, and I'm willing to do that.
And we might have to go back to GTC anyway, right, because of the way that it's operating and the ethical part of it. You know,
I'm fine with that.
If we don't get an attorney to run for that office, we definitely have to go back there. So I guess it's a kind of wait and see game to see, you know, what needs to be done, and then we can definitely plan, because there's a couple elements to the motion too that need to be changed. I think, you know, like
you're clarified.
Saying, clarified intent. Yep. And then making sure that the roles and responsibilities are clear. So, yeah, because some of the, you know, I think there's been discussions I have gone on with some of the attorneys, and they're like, well, I don't want that position, you know. Like, I have to supervise elected advocates, and they get to represent in the judiciary. I'm putting my reputation and license on the line for, you know, it's enough to just put my license on the line for myself, but now I have to do that for the advocates as well. So there's some clarifying things that we should probably, that we need to talk about, but for this sake right now, what I'm trying to do is just get the number, the qualifications to the election board to be on the ballot for July, and then also to get the budget done.
And, you know, the irony to that, that maybe you can't, you're out there finding out if there's any interested attorneys, but the irony to that is the judiciary opens the door for advocates. They open the door for lay people. Mm-hmm. That's how you get in. You don't necessarily have to be an attorney with your Juris Doctorate to practice there or litigate there, so the door's been open, you know. So anyways, mm-hmm. I just want to say that.
Yep. And I don't mind having advocates. I'm not against that at all. It's just making sure that we're having them be successful, following the rules, and following, you know, not having to sacrifice their own, you know, either if they have licenses or some sort of professional ethics that they have to follow. You know, I want them to be able to do that without fear of, you know, what's going to happen to me. Because it could ruin their career if the attorney's license should be, you know, suspended or taken away, or the advocate's paralegal certifications are, you know, compromise somehow. So we don't want to do that either. I know that wasn't the intent of that either. So, all right. So we had discussion on the number of positions. I'm just going to go around the table. The question will be, do you agree with the current proposal of one attorney and two advocates? Or if you say yes, you agree with that. If you say no, then we're going to have to discuss like one and three. Okay? So I'll start with Jenny.
Yes, I agree. I think it's reasonable.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes, with the understanding that we'll take the next year to assess, with possibly adding in at the 18 election cycle additional ones if we need to.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes, support.
Okay. Thank you. Next is go ahead, Brandon.
Just lastly, you know, I think we'll need to bring it back to the GTC. You know, we're looking at developing, kind of like with the judicial officers, they have their canons of judicial conduct. And so I think they're going to have some guiding principles on how they interact and how the ability of this attorney or supervising whomever that is to have the ability to do some things, you know, when these judicial canons of conduct, or, you know, I'm just looking only at the judiciary and how they have guiding principles on how they conduct their business. And if there's something in an ethical standard something can happen, and then there's a process that they would have to go through, and I think that's something that's definitely needed, and we're going to have to work on that as soon as we can.
Okay, thank you. The next issue is the job description. The qualifications and job descriptions. You have the job descriptions before you. First question is, are there any questions about the job descriptions? We'll go to the wages second, so we'll just talk about the job description for now. Come on, Lane. Come on up.
Oh, yeah. I had a couple of questions on the job description. For the advocate.
Okay.
The second page where it's under the minimum qualifications.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and there were items to be submitted. It said item must provide a copy of diploma, license, degree, or certification with the application. So if these are elected positions, when you submit your candidate packet,
yes,
you have to have this. Okay, but nobody knows about these right now, and there's already less than 30 days prior to the election. And according to the Appeals Commission, it takes anywhere from 2 weeks to a month to be certified as an advocate or to practice in, you know.
So what will happen is if there's an interested party that wants to run for the advising attorney or the advocate, they would go to caucus and get nominated just like anybody else. And when they fill out their packet, they would have to fill out the rules of admission for the judiciary. And just like anybody else that wants to run any for any qualifications, they have to be vetted before they're put on the ballot.
Right.
If they're not admitted to the judiciary, they're not technically a candidate.
But this one says, you know, the supervising attorney says that it says you must submit this certification upon employment. But the advocate says you have to submit the application or the certification with the application. And what I'm standing there saying is if I'm going to the caucus on March 25th and I submit my packet on March 27th, I haven't been certified yet because it's going to take me anywhere from 2 weeks to a month.
I see what you're saying.
You see what I'm saying?
I see what you're saying too now, but I think that for the advocate, the diploma, license, degree, or certification is referencing your educational stuff. It's not referencing your rules of admission. For the attorney, it would be your Juris Doctorate degree. It would be your certificate of good standing.
But what I'm standing saying is you still have to be certified to be an advocate, do you not?
No,
I mean,
not necessarily.
The court has to accept you.
Right, after the fact. You can do it after. So you can, if you qualify from an educational perspective as an advocate, you still have to apply under the rules of admission for the judiciary, and you could do that after you've been in caucus or submitted your candidate's packet.
Right. You just don't be, you're still an applicant at that point, so they have time from the time they become.
Okay, but
from
then
the time
what
period
is
of the application to becoming a candidate, there's a time period in there.
What is the cutoff for that then? Because
we have to work with the election board to make sure that the applicants know what that deadline is for them to submit their material in order for them to become a candidate. And that's whatever that 30 days is prior to the election. So they have till June, I'm assuming, whatever that day is.
In this case, but 2 years from now when that, you know, when you open the advocate up again, okay, there's not the 3 months between.
Right, so that's the backward schedule that the election board will have to make sure that they have in place in order to make sure that people understand what their timeline is in order to become.
I just think there should be some type of timeline put in there that, you know, for them to be certified by the Appeals Commission or the judiciary
to become a candidate. They will when they get the candidates packet. Rocky and I can't remember the other person's name, they're already aware from the election board standpoint that this is going to occur. So they're going to have to put into place the deadlines for them to be certified by the judiciary to become an advocate or, you know, a practicing advising attorney. If they are not, they won't be a candidate.
Okay.
But thank you for the item submitted because it is different on both. We'll get that cleared up. Any questions on the job descriptions? Juan?
I was going to question about the advocate also under items to be submitted, actually number two. So why do you need three letters of recommendation if it's an elected position? Who's going to read it? The people voting?
As far as I know, that was a discussion that was occurred at General Tribal Council that they wanted to have letter of reference just to make sure that the person has advocated in other settings or had experience. So that would be submitted when they fill out the candidates packet and the election board and HRD, they have an MOU that talks about how to vet those things. So no, the community will not get a copy of the letter of references. They're basically used to say, again, just like the rules of admission, you have to have them in order to become a candidate.
I think I questioned it before, too, under minimum qualifications, associate's degree in human resources. I don't know if we could put comma, paralegal studies.
Advocate?
Yeah, under number one, it says associate's degree in human resources, maybe inserting comma, paralegal studies.
The next one is the paralegal certification, and related field does include paralegal.
That's studies. Different. A certificate versus a degree are separate.
Right, but so it says associate's degree in human resources or related field. Related field is considered for this position paralegal studies. Not unless you want me to, I mean, if the committee wants me to put it in there, I don't have a problem doing that.
I think it just needs to be a little bit more.
I don't know. When I think of human resource, I'm like, okay, front desk lady or training somebody on,
right?
Not advocacy and law.
I can add it.
Because I think we should also include it to expand legal studies or you know, there's other degrees that can be included with where I think the intent is trying to get to say that, because I think they need, I think people should have understanding of HR issues, but because this is a broader advocacy, it's not just personnel, they need to have understanding of law and process. And so having a general understanding of HR issues is different than saying having HR experience.
That related field, I think, is subjective.
It is.
Can you take that off?
And this what? Really specifically talks about.
I mean, they're right. That doesn't necessarily help someone know how to litigate cases or know the process or how to work it.
Right, but related field is like so open. But I hear what they're saying about clarifying it, you know, making it. I'll have to come back with a list.
I think we can use the judiciary list as like a laundry list of things that people can use because we're pretty inclusive in the judiciary law about the types of degrees that are acceptable for bachelor's degrees for trial judges. I think even though the degree level and the years of experience are different, I think that laundry list of things that's in the judiciary is what we could use as the guide.
I can make that change.
I mean, in budget.
That was my only concern, was that related field, otherwise.
Okay.
When will this go back to GTC?
It's not. At this point, okay. We've got a couple of things where we have to go get, I think we're going to have to get clarification, but I think we also have to wait until the election or the caucus to see first if somebody runs, and if somebody runs, then we'll have to look at the policy part of it, too, and I just don't want to go back piecemeal.
Okay.
We need to go back comprehensively and say this is working, and but these are some of the clarifications, or this just isn't working and we need to revamp it and get, you know, to what the vision was.
The other question that I have is regarding the letters of reference. Is it allowed for people to submit those letters of reference from anywhere, from anybody, or is it to be
baseline? You can have anyone say anything.
Right, that's my question, because, and I'll just use myself as an example. If I were to decide to do this, I would go to the court and say, you know, I worked as a GAL. Could you provide me a letter of reference because of my experience working as a GAL, versus going to an actual client that I might have had advocated for in the past and say, as a client, can you write me a letter of reference saying that I have advocacy experience? So my question is, would both types be acceptable, or is this something that we're looking for that's more from a professional perspective? Because I could go back to, like, my professors or my whoever in order to get those references saying, yes, you have experience in trial court, and this is, you know, I'm going to recommend you for this position. Or is it very, very loose and nonspecific about what we're looking for? So I would ask, actually, Gina, that question as well.
I believe the judiciary, you can look at what they require for a letter of reference. I'm not sure. I know I'm admitted there, so I can practice there, and I don't recollect. There is criteria.
Yep.
So, I mean, we can utilize that. I really, to be honest, I'm not even in favor of this being on there because, you know, they're going to have to get those letters of reference just to, you know, practice at the judiciary. And then if they do provide, you know, like if it's required that they provide that with their application, who is evaluating, determining whether those references are, you know, good references or not? Who's making that determination?
Right. And that's what I said, the election board in conjunction with HRD would be looking at the reference. And at that point, the only reason why it's in here is because that was a discussion that occurred at General Tribal Council. You suggested that they have letters of reference to validate their years of experience or to validate that you have advocacy. It was mostly for the advocates, or actually it's only for the advocates. So when we were working through this process, I agree with you, it has no value at this point because they do have to have some letters of reference for the rules of admission. But because it was on the GTC, you know, it was a suggestion, I wanted to make sure I included it because other jobs are required and it just says letters of reference and it doesn't say letters of reference relevant to. It just says letters of reference, and there's no requirement. So if you want to take it out, if the committee is willing to take it out, I'm okay with that as well. Lisa?
I guess at this point I would recommend that we do take it out. I think hearing the feedback from Gina helps validate that, because I think what we know is part of the process is that you have to have the letter of reference included through the admission process. And I think if a person is successful going through the admission process, then that's the test that's already been completed, and then it's included in that process. So it's not like we still wouldn't be doing it. It would just be included in somewhere else. It just wouldn't be a standalone item.
Okay. Take it out. Okay. All right. Any other questions on the job description?
I know that we talked about making sure that this is enrolled tribal members only, and I don't know if that states it on here. I just want to...
I thought it was. Minimum qualifications number 4 in the supervising attorney, and minimum qualification number 3 says must be an enrolled Oneida tribal member.
Okay.
Anybody else? If not, on to the pay. And again, the... like any job description that the business committee develops, we do go to HRD and ask them to do a wage analysis for the positions. And so I didn't change anything on the positions for the supervising attorney or the advocate. I know that the petitioner had, or I shouldn't call you a petitioner, I'm so used to it, Gina had some concerns around the wages. And I guess, you know, the only thing that I could say is that even for the judiciary, when we went and did a wage analysis for the judges, there was a lot of people that said, we're not going to get anybody to apply for these positions because of the wages, but we never changed them because it was a wage analysis that was conducted by HRD, was in line with industry, didn't skew our compensation scale, our wage scale. So we left it from a judicial perspective, and that those were elected. So I didn't change it, and I know that Gina is saying that the both positions are low. The supervising attorney did take into consideration the current attorneys that work for the nation overall, not just in the law office. It took the advocates, they looked at, because there's no real position that's similar to this, they took the, they looked at the current advocates that are serving at gaming as well as on the non-gaming side of the house. And I believe they just, that was the basis of the analysis. So I don't know what y'all, or Gina, did you want to present why you feel that it's out of line?
Well, when we spoke on the phone, I did state that that hourly wage for advocates, I thought it was low due to the fact that they are going to be involved in various issues other than just employment. And I had stated that back in 1999, I worked as an advocate for Oneida Gaming, and that's the wage I made in 1999. And so I felt it was low as a starting wage. And even though it says negotiable depending on education and experience, a lot of times HRD doesn't allow you to negotiate. I think that with the current wage scale, or the last wage scale that I was able to review was from 2007. And I feel that that the salary is starting low. I think it should be starting at $20 an hour. That's the minimum, I think, because they are dealing with a variety of issues. You only have two starting. And I think on one of these pages in the packet where you have the FY 2017 budget, okay, that's not the page I was looking at. You had something in here that you were using, the page after that, where it says startup grand total for 2017. It says personnel advocate based on $20 per hour salary. So I think that should be the starting point. I think it should be the low end of that scale. And I'm just, you know, whatever rationale you guys come up with to start a position at low, that's on you, but I don't agree with it. I just need to state that for the record. I think it's low, and I also think that the attorney, mind you, you know, they're going to be in all the general tribal council meetings and representing general tribal council at that point. I know that you have your parliamentarian there, and chief counsel does that. I don't know if that's part of her job description, what have you. But that was one of the intents, that General Tribal Council had their own attorney there. That way, when there's legal opinions asked of chief counsel / parliamentarian, you know, they may ask that same legal question to the General Tribal Council's attorney. So I just thought the wage was low. And so I just want on record that I thought that would starting at $80,000, and that the advocates would start at $20 an hour. And I think that you would be able to get people that would be willing to expand their knowledge of litigation. Some of them are only like the employee advocates at gaming. Mind you, they're probably making way more than this, and they only do employment. They don't do anything else. Same thing with the compliance advocate. You used to have two, Tammy Hill and Rena Matoxin, and you know, at that point they had a supervising attorney. I don't know what their wages are, but right now, from what I know, and I know this because I've had to refer cases to Rena that were not employment cases, she says we only do employment. So for those advocates that have to expand their knowledge and experience in litigating other issues besides, you know, employment, I think their pay has to be higher. I just really do.
Okay.
So that's where I stand on that.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. Any other questions or comments on the legal resources?
Well, the way that we were going was So we're under qualifications and job descriptions. We're just taking the memorandum section by section. So, and I've just been asking by consensus of the committee to concur or make changes. So at this point, we're done with the job descriptions. We were just talking about the pay.
Okay.
And so I haven't asked the committee whether or not they agree with the current pay that's on here, because it's done by HRD wage analysis. And then Gina has points that she's saying, well, you know, based upon the analysis that was done by GTC or by HRD, that she believes that they need to be bumped up a little bit more. So
I do, just taking in consideration the areas that will be litigated. It's not just employment. It's going to be, you know, whatever it is, housing, evictions, whatever comes to the table, and that's what they'll be doing. It's more than just employment. So I did state, I don't know if you're in here because I was looking down, but the wage on here is what I made in 1999 as an advocate for gaming. And what I did as an advocate is our scope of what we did was restricted to employment. So these advocates will not be just doing employment. They will be doing other areas of litigation. So I felt like the wage was low. I also disagree with HRD I know that it takes them a lot of time, and I don't know if we have an up-to-date wage scale that General Tribal Council has approved or not, but the wage scale that they're using, I believe it's more than 10 years old. And so that's my objection. And like I said, I know that this body is going to make a determination regardless of what I state here, but I'm objecting to that, and I will bring this up when we do clarify before General Tribal Council. I know money is a big issue within the tribe. At least we say it is. But I do think that if you want good people, you want people that have experience and knowledge, that you have to pay them. You can't, you know, shortchange them. So
would you be, or Melinda, be in consideration of raising the education requirements then? Because I think that's where you get to that. You want more qualified, you want more people that have the ability to do these type of things, would generally have more education and more experience. And so that's where another way we can bump up the wage by, because we're going to get a systematic number if we plug in. That's how it happens, you know, the wage scale based on years of experience and education. But if we bump that up, then that wage would go up. And so I think that's kind of where I would be in agreement, but I don't know if you want to keep that experience low so we get more bigger, a broader pool.
I think that the what we have as far as the minimal qualifications, we talked about that degree, or related field with 2 years of experience, of 2 years of employee relations experience as an employee, as a paralegal. It says paralegal certification from an accredited institution and 2 years of experience in problem solving. Okay, so you want a degree with 2 years of employee relations experience or paralegal certification from an accredited institution and 2 years of experience in problem solving through litigation or negotiation and or equivalent. Okay, so maybe in that and 2 years of experience in problem solving through litigation or negotiation, maybe bump that up.
The one thing that I could do is, because again, just bring it here initially, the importance of approving the job description is really the qualifications and the roles and responsibilities section of it. So if the committee wants, I can bring back, you know, some options from the Human Resources Department. But really, the point is to try to get the qualifications approved today, because they have to go to the election board by March 4th in order to get on the ballot.
Mm-hmm.
So if you want me to bring back a different salary, that's fine. But, or, you know, because I think Gina has a point for the advocate, at least, that the advocate does more than just what the other advocates do. They don't just do personnel-related issues, and I can bring that up. As for the attorney is negotiated by depending on experience, so it could be higher. That's why I put it in the budget at a higher rate. So, but if you're just getting somebody fresh out of law school, has a little bit of experience, you know.
I mean, but it says, yeah. But yeah, the job description says they have to have, the attorney has to have, you know, with 2 years of previous successful experience practicing law and or equivalent combination of education experience.
Right.
So they're not, you know, they will have some experience somewhere.
But that's what I mean. They could come right out of school. They could be practicing for 2 years and make $76,000. Pretty good.
Yeah, well, they got their JD.
Right. So, an advocate, I see where you're going. So, if the committee is agreeable, I could go back and rework the numbers on the salary part of it. But for the sake of getting the information to the election board, I need the qualifications, duties, responsibilities, things like that approved today.
Okay. So, on the salary, I mean, on that N12, that grade, there must be something in there that's close to the $20 an hour, because according to the budget that we're using, that's what you based it on. It was based on $20 per hour.
I based it on $20 per hour because I felt that because I needed some leeway in case somebody did come in with higher qualifications, higher experience levels, that there was some negotiation room. So that's why I budgeted for $20 an hour per advocate, because I needed that wiggle room, because I don't know that we're going to have people coming in at $17.76 per hour. So I needed to make sure I had room in the budget for negotiation purposes. So I did base it off of $20 an hour.
Lisa?
I'm okay with the request for us to approve the qualifications at this point and then have a revised job description come back with an updated wage analysis. That has, because we made the other change too about adding the different kinds of degrees and everything. The other thing is too, maybe what would be helpful just for the report purposes is to make sure that the range is in there, because each one of these has a range, and we can just put that in there so that it's clear. Because I think it should be negotiable, and I think we have a process that we modeled now when we did the judiciary. And so HRD did do those negotiations, so not everybody's equal at this point. It is based on education and experience. So I think there is a way for us to do that as long as we make sure that we have the money in the budget as those things happen. So I would agree with moving forward at this point then.
Here's his hand up. Now, David.
Yeah, I'm okay with changing it as well. But underneath salary, the employee will receive 5% below negotiated pay rate during their probationary status. Could we remove that from both of them, because they're not going to be on probation?
Okay. Yep.
I didn't hear your last sentence. What did you say?
Underneath salary on the job description, there's a line that's bold. This is employees receive 5%. Mm-hmm. I want that removed.
Oh, good. So just to clarify this then, I wanted the base $20 an hour. That's what I wanted it to start out at. Not that's the top that they would negotiate, but that would be the baseline. Just because, like I said, 1999, we're talking 10, 17 years ago. That's what I was working at, you know, as an advocate, 17 years. That's a long time. And like I said, the scope of their work is going to be more than just employment.
Brendan?
Yeah, I guess I would kind of agree with that, too, because you want a base for an elected position. You don't want ability to come in and negotiate as an elected official on your experience. It just kind of seems, I think we're entering a new kind of arena here, an elected position, creating a job description based on it and the qualifications. And I think it's just a new thing we're doing. But I'd feel less uneasy about an elected official coming in, being able to go negotiate after the fact they've been elected. You know, what happens after that? I think there's just more transparency there if you're able to just have a set number come in. And you know, business committee is set by general tribal council. if our qualifications and all the stuff that we did, you know, what would our wage be? Be kind of way up there. But I think there's kind of an arbitrary thing we're doing here, and I would agree with it in any other, I would disagree with it in any other case, but I think this one, because it's an elected position, it needs to be set outside of that wage salary that you would generate, because it's the duties are different. And so I would feel more comfortable having a set wage.
Lisa?
I understand what you're saying, and I think that's why I'm asking for the range to be brought back, because then we'll know the minimum, the mid, and the max for the range that it came back from the analysis, because I think we should still be making a decision based on the analysis. I don't want us to get involved in that part, because it's like done by a third party at this point. But I think then if we have that range as part of the report, then we can say this is why we chose this number, because it fit within, you know, it was between the minimum and the mid, or it was between the mid and the maximum or whatever, so that we have, like what you're saying, it's more transparent that way.
Yeah, I'd be agreeable with that, yeah.
Trish?
Just for purposes of the budget, if we wait for something to come back, it'll be after the budget. So I'm a little concerned about what you want me to put in this budget. It's currently balanced with what's in front of us today. So I don't know if you want to talk about that now or when we get into the budget. But
well, like I said, Gina's saying $80,000 for the attorney, $20 an hour for the advocate. That's what I based my budget on. It was $80,000 for the attorney, $20 an hour for the advocate if the committee agrees to full-time status. We haven't talked about that yet.
Okay.
So
that's good.
That's what the budget is based upon. Plus, it's got fringe and indirects. So if there's a discussion about going to, like, stipended, because you guys did agree to go to stipended, but I did based on full-time analysis because of the job descriptions, then that's another discussion. And I think that amount of money will cover because of the lateness of getting them on board in the fiscal year. We won't get them inaugurated until August. They would need to work. They won't be taking on cases probably for another month or two. So I think that we're okay in that sense.
Any other comments or questions?
So the next section is length of term staggered. Anybody have an issue with that, I guess?
Good with that.
The length of term was staggered and the length. Good.
The next issue would be the pay structure, stipend versus full time. So the question to the committee at the time, we had some limited discussion around the pay structure. The pay structure was based on stipends. I did not make a formal recommendation to the business committee with this type of request because there was not enough historical data or enough data for caseload, just as we talked about earlier, to make a well-rounded decision on this issue. But there was some concerns that were brought to my attention from the business committee, from Gina, as well as other individuals around some of the things that we should take into consideration. And one was, of course, interest and candidacy for the position. If this position is stipended, if it is a stipended pay position, what will the interest be to run for this office? And it could go either way. It could be positive, where people can continue to work in their current job and then be stipended to take on cases from the GTC Legal Resource Center. On the other hand, people may not be apt to take it because it is a stipended position. So it could go either way. Budget and fiscal issues. I thought that if the advocates would be full-time, there would be administrative support in the center, in the office, along with the advising attorney. That way there would be no need to hire an admin person. Also, looking at some of the concerns that the LOC had with the stipends with the Oneida Appeals Commission, the previous business committees had concerns with regards to the way that the stipend payment process was working and how to control costs in that arena. And then cost effectiveness. again, could go either way. If we hire full-time, we would be paying fringe and indirect. If we went stipended, we wouldn't be paying fringe or indirect. So could be cheaper to go with a stipend. So I asked the business committee to reconsider their decision or to provide additional guidance on the stipend structure. And so one of the structures that was brought forward was currently how the guardian ad litems work with the family court. So the guardian ad litems are assigned a case to work on. They are paid by the hour. And I believe, Brianne, you said this morning that they could be paid in 15-minute increments depending on the type of work that they do. So they would be, they would also incur any kind of mileage expense. They would incur any kind of expenses that came out of pocket, but since we have the Legal Resources Center where they can make copies, scan, print, those kind of things, that center would be available for them to utilize the resources. So basically the decision is whether or not these should be full-time positions or continue to be stipended, and we would have to work on a pay structure and so forth, but at this time, I don't believe that the budget would change. And I know that Gina didn't agree with the stipend. She believed that we should hire them full-time.
Yeah, and then I will state that for the record, I'm not in favor of bringing any of the staff on as being on stipends. The issue that I have with the stipends is, number one, how would that be paid out? You know, like you said, they were comparing it to like the guardian ad litems. The issue I have with that is that if we're expecting to bring people on that already have a job, they might have a job, so they're just going to do this for stipends. All the hours of court are 8 to 4:30. That's during normal work hours. So say, for instance, I wanted to do this, I'm going to have to choose one or the other, because you can't, you know, in the tribe, how are you going to work 8 to 4:30? Then all the hearings within our court system are just 8 to 4:30. We don't have night court and things of that nature. So I just think I'm not for the stipends. I don't know how you would even say that on a job description, that this is not an employee position. It's a stipend. You will not you'll get a W-9 or 1099 at the end of the year. I'm just not in favor of it at all. I think that the advocates that would work, some of the work that they're going to be doing is researching and things of that nature. And, you know, that could be hours and hours depending on what the nature of the case that they have is. And you do that all during the day, and how would you bill someone, or how they would be billing you for hours of, I guess, research and stuff. And I just think it's for me, it's more cost effective and it's more stable for you to have employees versus, I guess, people getting a stipend.
Jenny?
Oh, I think they should be full-time as well. I think it would be a disservice to go with the stipends because of the time that it would take for the research for the cases. So I would have to agree with the full-time.
Anyone else? So is there a recommendation around salary and fringe, and we had a chance to consider that?
Yeah, we already talked about that. Okay. And then the budget is next, so we can talk about the budget. I can tell you what the numbers are based on.
Okay.
So full-time it is then?
Okay. That's what the consensus is.
Okay. Then the next item is the FY17 budget. You have a copy of that budget in your packet. That budget is had been slightly revamped. There you go. The grand total for FY17 is $57,354. And that would get us through 7 weeks of employment based upon the inauguration date. and I put mid-August, second week of August, and then also 3 months of building use. So the building would be in use from July, August, September. So also the decision about employment numbers was based on the election schedule that was just approved by General Tribal Council, with the business committee certifying the results on August 9th, and then the inauguration taking place that following week. So 7 weeks of employment. As you can see in the budget, the personnel line is budgeted at 7 weeks. I budgeted the attorney at $80,000. I budgeted the advocates at $20 per hour, calculated the fringe and direct professional liability service. The suite 8 is being patched up and painted. There's really nothing new that's needed, so I took out this. It said startup, so there was no remodeling that needed to be done, so that line was zero. The only thing that really changed was heat and lights went up by $25 based upon a recommendation from DPW. So that's the FY17 budget. See anything, Rolinda?
No.
Okay. Is there any questions on that?
Trish, can you work that into the budget? Is that already worked in?
Yes, I believe this is appropriate. She worked with Melinda on trying to find all of the costs associated with it. So it's been validated and supported by finance. And so I don't have any issues with it.
And then next was the FY18. That was just FYI. Again, based on the salaries, there's still some numbers that need to be worked out. For example, one-time costs and things like that for computers and stuff, but other than that. The next thing is administrative procedures, rules for the GTC legal resources. It's the policy development that we've been talking about all morning. The business committee, from their February 14th work meeting, asked that the business committee, or that the LOC, be directed to begin the policy work for the GTC legal resource center. And then the Oneida Code of Laws training, there was also a motion in there that training for all Oneida laws be done and offered beginning in the fall. Jesse Wallenfang is working with HRD under training and development to begin to, because training and development can do all the employment stuff, but then all the other stuff is going to have to be brought in. So they're working on a training schedule and also identifying the appropriate entities to administer that training. So they're trying to work in a schedule to comply with that motion as well. So the requested actions today would be approve the GTC Legal Resources Center with the changes that we just vetted and proceed. Direct myself to send a memo to the election board with the qualifications and number of positions to be placed on the 2017 general election ballot. And then direct the LOC to add the GTC Legal Resource Center governing documents to the active files list as a high priority.
So moved. Unless it's your motion, I'll second.
Sure.
Can you repeat your motion, please?
Sure. The first item would be to approve the GTC Legal Resource Center with the changes that we made today and proceed. Direct the Vice Chairwoman to send a memorandum to the Election Board with the qualifications and number of positions to be placed upon the 2017 general election ballot with the changes that were made today. And then direct the LOC to add the GTC Legal Resource Center governing documents to the active files list as a high priority item.
Second.
Can you be more specific about the changes? I know we discussed them.
There is so many.
That's why, okay. I think it needs to be noted so that there's no misunderstanding going down the road.
Let's see. Changes to the job description. Let's for the supervising attorney, the change, I would bring back a new wage analysis to the business committee at a future date. Remove under salary, employees will receive 5% below the negotiated pay rate during their probationary status. Under items to be submitted, clarify the terminology upon employment, possibly saying, referencing the candidate's packet instead of upon employment. Under the advocate position, again, the salary, the committee wanted me to review the wage analysis and then remove the employees will receive 5% below the negotiated pay rate during their probationary status. Under minimum qualifications, they wanted the associate's degree, they wanted the related fields listed, possibly looking at the judiciary for some guidance on the educational part of it. And then under items to be submitted, delete number 2, which is must submit 3 letters of reference of current references, because that is a requirement under the rules of admission. Under item submitted number 1, clarify with application, again possibly referencing the candidate's packet. Under the pay structure, the business committee reversed this decision and would like the positions to be full time. And then noting the change in the FY17 budget for there's no need for any kind of startup or remodeling costs. And the heat and lights, it used to be called, oh boy, it was called electricity, is now called the heat and lights, and it went up by $25 from $625 to $650. So the grand total for FY17 is now $57,354, which will go into the next item on the agenda, which is the budget. So.
Thank you. There's a motion made by Melinda, seconded by Brandon, to accept the GTC legal resources recommendations, and that Vice Chair will follow up on the election board requirements for the ballot. The LLC shall move this item to the active files list. The job description changes. The attorney wage and analysis will come back at a future date, nonspecific. Revenue or the probation language will be deleted. There will be a clarification regarding terminology for candidates' packet. The information will go into the packet. Advocate review of the wage. Again, a deletion of probationary language. Minimum qualifications for associate degree. And then that there will be an educational recommendation input from, did you say?
Possibly the judiciary
law.
They wanted me to look at the judiciary law for the education.
There will be 3 letters of recommendation required. And again, that all this information will go into the candidate's packet. The pay schedule will become full-time employee rather than a stipend position. And all of these requirements costs shall be included in the fiscal year 17 budget at $57,354. Anything else, David?
Just to clarify that these letters of current references is to be deleted from the job description.
Okay.
Because it's already required in the rules of admission.
Okay.
I just wanted some clarification from Melinda. If the fringe and indirect is for the $17 an hour, or was it for the $20 an hour on the back?
The fringe and indirect costs were calculated at the $20
okay.
per hour.
So we should be fine then.
All right. That's the motion made by Melinda, seconded by Brandon. Any other discussion, questions, or comments? If not, all those in favor of the motion, say aye.
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 Any opposed? Any abstentions? Motion carries.
Thank you, Gina, for taking the time to be with us this morning.
Thank you.
And Rhea.
Lisa? Next item on the agenda is a 2017 budget addendum.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Trish.
To the Finance Department, but first I'd just like to acknowledge that our fiscal year 2017 budget does remain at $453,500,224. With the additions to the recent actions of the General Tribal Council, Larry and Melinda can identify where those funds are covered from, but it didn't affect the bottom line. So this packet that's presented today is the additional packet that would be mailed out with the original budget that has all of the other consolidated information in it. This report shows where the changes are made and how it affects the budget, which bottom line, that there isn't an effect. So, Melinda, if you can give a detailed overview.
Good morning. As the treasurer indicated, the budget remains at $453,500,224 because the revenue did not change. The balancing act was to get the additional expenditures in within that revenue dollar amount. The additional expenditures that have been included in the $453.5 million budget is an additional six GTC meetings. Originally there were six. There are now 12. The stipends amount is $1.2 million. The meeting expense is $662,400. General Tribal Council petition for the food pantry, 309-459. I took that off of the fiscal impact statement. The GTC, when it was presented to me, it was called Attorney and Advocacy. It's now the Legal Resource Center, so I would like to change that verbiage. $57,354 for the first year, and then the food pantry capital equipment of $49,500. The following line items were reduced in order to maintain a balanced budget. The gaming 2% net profit contingency was zeroed out. That was $2,037,621. The retail 2% net...
$2,037,261. You said 621.
Oh,
sorry.
The retail 2% net profit contingency was reduced to zero. That was $209,492. And the permanent executive contingency had to be reduced by $31,960. There still remains $3,368,040 in the permanent executive contingency allocation. On the detailed pages, the first page does not change because that's our sources of funding. On the second page, which is called Allocations for Tribal Operations, I have highlighted in yellow the columns and dollar amounts that have changed. I would recommend that when it's printed that the highlighting remain. The next page, which is called Fiscal Year 2017 Budget Revised for March 27th, 2017 meeting, is just a roll-up. And again, the columns that have changed have been highlighted in yellow, and those changes have been brought forward into the detail packet as well. Line 257 adds the Oneida Emergency Food Pantry operational costs. Line 265 is General Tribal Council, and that would be the meeting expenses. Line 267 would be changed to read GTC Legal Resource Center. That is the $57,354. I did notice in the original packet there was a typo on line 317. Originally, when the packet was sent out, it said $1,000 for the membership per capita. That has been changed to read $1,300. I apologize. That's a hard-coded title in that report, and I have had that corrected. GTC meeting stipends, that line has increased to $2.28 million. That's line 320. Line 324 is increased by $49,500 for the operational equipment for the Oneida Emergency Food Pantry. And then lines 329, 330, and 331 have also been changed.
Lisa?
I'll make a motion to approve the supplemental materials that were presented for the packet.
Second.
Motion by Lisa, seconded by David, to approve the revised supplemental packet for the GTC mail out with the noted changes for highlighting.
Just to be clear. Okay, but before we, just to be clear, this is supplemental material, not there's additional material yet from the budget, right? This is in addition to.
This is in
not
addition.
Replacing, right, it's
in, correct.
Okay,
it's in addition to the original packet. Right. The recommendation is for the original packet, which has already been printed,
yep,
to be sent out, and then this added to the
yep
back
okay
of that.
Okay, I just want to make sure that's clear. Thank you.
This change, yes.
Are you okay with the highlights?
Yes.
That's
yes
the only thing that changed. Okay. Relinda?
I also want to clarify that I left the line numbers the same from the original packet to this packet to allow people to be able to follow them.
Thank you.
And will these be highlighted when they get mailed out?
That would be my recommendation that the that it be sent out highlighted as presented.
Yep, that way they can see what was changed. Thanks.
Any other questions or comments, recommendations on the motion to approve the supplemental information to go to Jones Tribal Council with the noted changes highlighted? If there are no other questions or comments regarding the motion to approve the supplemental information, motion by Lisa, second by David. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Any abstentions? Motion carries.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair,
yes,
make a motion to go into executive session.
Second.
It's a motion to go into executive session. Do we need to approve the waiver first or no? The WEX, did you do that already?
That's what we're going into exec for.
Okay.
The contract.
All right. Do we need Larry for this item? If not, then you can please excuse yourselves, everybody. There's a motion by Lisa to go into executive session at 11:35. Is there support?
Second.
Second by Fawn. All those in favor of executive session, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Any abstentions? Motion carries. Ended to come out of executive session at 11:55. All those in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed? Abstentions? Motion carries. Regarding the WX item recommendation.
Motion to defer to the next meeting, BC meeting.
So motion to defer, is there support?
Support.
Motion to defer the WX contract, bank contract, by David, second by Fawn. This is a deferral to the next BC meeting. All those in favor say aye.
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 Any opposed? Any abstentions? Motion carries.
Motion, second.
Motion to adjourn by David, seconded by Lisa. All those in favor of the motion to adjourn, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Abstentions? Motion carries.